Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's continue now with our ongoing series of conversations with members of Massachusetts' congressional delegation. Congressman Joe Kennedy III, who represents the state's 4th congressional district, stopped by last hour. We talked to him about a number of issues, beginning with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, who faces allegations of sexual assault from at least two women.
This is extremely serious. It's serious because you're talking about the lifetime appointment for an individual to the highest court in the land. And I think at the core of that, more than political ideology, comes down to honesty and integrity and a question as to whether somebody's telling the truth. And we've got a couple of issues here with regards to Mr. Kavanaugh. One is what happened. Both of these allegations are decades ago. But what happened during those allegations? And was he truthful in his testimony to the U.S. Senate and therefore to the American public? And I do think that the best way you're going to get an answer to that is to have some sort of third party do an investigation and try to figure out to the best of anybody's ability what happened so that you're not just in this he said, she said argument.
So this would be an argument in favor of an FBI investigation,
that,
for example.
That third party in our countries for these issues is typically the FBI. Yeah. And so I do think that I understand it's inconvenient for my Republican colleagues, and I understand it comes off as a surprise and a shock and all of the rest of it. And I'd say, look, that's unfortunate, no doubt about it. But I also think now that you're talking about, given the severity of what's at stake, that it is worth making sure that the United States Senate and the American public know exactly who it is that they're seeking to confirm for potentially the next 30-plus years to the United States Supreme Court. And look, I was a domestic violence prosecutor for a little while when I was in serving the court system here in Massachusetts. Cases like this are extremely difficult. They're difficult to prove. We're not talking about a court of law at this point.
Right.
But you are talking about allegations of her versus him. And let's take a minute to see if there's other corroborating evidence, either on one side or the other. But the women certainly deserve a chance to be heard. They deserve their chance to make sure that their story is told and that authorities check it out. And Mr. Kavanaugh, I think, deserves the same.
So let me ask you about that, because some of Judge Kavanaugh's defenders say he's in a tough position because he has to essentially disprove a negative. Is that a valid concern? Or, you know, give me your take as a former prosecutor.
Well, so let's be clear. What's at stake here is just whether Mr. Kavanaugh is able to get 50 votes out of the United States Senate and get confirmed with 51 from Mr. Pence. Mr. McConnell, the majority leader, has said that he's going to plow on through no matter what, which is a pretty stunning thing to hear from the Senate majority leader, that the testimony of these women doesn't matter to him. Lindsey Graham has actually said the same thing, that there's nothing that Professor Ford can say that's going to sway his opinion, sway his vote, which is also a pretty stunning thing to hear from a sitting U.S. senator about and tells you an awful lot about how they're thinking about the validity of these allegations.
What it tells me is there's a process down there that seems more about being political theater than actually trying to get to the truth.
Look, the process, unfortunately, from my perspective, is the acquisition and maintenance of political power at all cost. And the recognition from my Senate Republican colleagues that at this point, it's that the timing is tight to try to confirm somebody else, and so they're just going to plow on through. That's a shame, because what's at stake here isn't the October 1st beginning of a Supreme Court term or whether he can get somebody, a fifth judge on the court by a date certain. One, if that's your issue, Mr. McConnell, you just delayed Merrick Garland for an entire year so that you could get a judge that you wanted instead. And so I would like to think that there's enough U.S. senators that understand that, as corny as it is, or perhaps as wonky as it is, the American public's faith in these institutions is actually critical to their functioning. And the last one still standing, as people have lost so much faith in Congress, and certainly a lot of folks have lost faith in the executive branch, is our court system. And yes, there's going to be political fights there. Fine. This is more than that. And I think it's worth taking the time to go through that process just to make sure that you do it as best you can. There's, yes, might be some hard calls and some disappointments here, given the nature of this one. But These women deserve to be heard. Mr. Kavanaugh deserves a chance to refute those or to put forth his own story. Absolutely. But short-circuiting this without giving the victims that process, I think, is a pretty dangerous precedent to set.
You know, it's interesting. I think it'd be really hard to disagree with what you just said in terms of these women deserve to be heard. There's no question about that. You also mentioned the name Merrick Garland, and that sort of brings this whole kind of political calculus into this. So it seems like this process, and things always are in Washington, there's some very substantive issues that you've described really well, but we're also dealing with a kind of, a really intense political game between Republicans and Democrats here, too. How do you separate them out? Can you separate them out?
Look, I'm not so sure you can wholly separate the politics from the substance. They're going to be intermingled on stuff like this. One, sure, fine. Judge Gorsuch got confirmed. Right.
Clarence Thomas got confirmed. Right.
There is a way, I think, to try to make sure that as you see this infiltration or infestation of politics in all parts of our democratic processes now, where you at some point we're going to be dependent on our political leadership to pull back a bit and say, let's make sure we get this process right. It doesn't mean you can totally inoculate the process from that political process or from those political motivations. But you can make sure that the majority of the American public believe that everybody was served and served well by their system. And at the moment, I think we can guarantee when I hear comments like, I don't care what an alleged victim is going to say, I'm just going to do it regardless. And you're hearing that out of the Senate Majority Leader and a high-ranking senator, and you just say, it doesn't matter, we're just going to force it through. That, to me, doesn't say, hey, we're actually going to have this process is as healthy as it should be. And the one other point that I think is important to note, no one's sitting there saying that instead of Judge Kavanaugh, you should get Judge Garland, right? I would love that. Mm-hmm. That's not exactly on the table, right? I think there's an acknowledgement from Democrats, at least in the House and Senate, that if you don't get Judge Kavanaugh, you still probably get – Republicans are still going to nominate a conservative judge. It's not like you're going to flip around and put a progressive on the bench. So this isn't saying, hey, go fill this with a Democrat. This is saying let's make sure that we know that the person you're confirming didn't perpetrate these sexual assaults, did not misrepresent or potentially lie to the United States Senate in his testimony. Let's make sure that's right. And let's make sure there's a process to figure that out. So it's not just that he said, she said in front of the American people on Thursday. Just spend a couple days, have the FBI investigate, have them do the best they can, given the resources that they have and the research that they can do. And at the very least, they might not come back with anything more, but at least you've enabled them to do what they can to ask that question.
Hmm. I want to move on to a couple of other issues closer to home. And let me ask you specifically about Ayanna Pressley, who defeated Congressman Michael Capuano in the 7th District Democratic primary. And this is a question sort of about the future of the Democratic Party. You, along with most members of the Democratic establishment, endorse Capuano. How come?
A couple things. One, a big congratulations to Ayanna. Ayanna is a friend. Ayanna worked for my father. She worked for Senator Kerry before he became a secretary. She's going to make a great colleague. And I look forward to welcoming her as a member of the delegation in January. I supported Mr. Capuano, in that race. Yes, Mike is a colleague. He's a coworker. He's a friend. He's been a mentor to me since I got into Congress. Congress is not always the most transparent place about how things operate. And so particularly for a newbie to be able to rely on some of those seasoned hands that have been there for a little while about committee process structure, how things get done, who to go to, how to handle yourself in certain circumstances is important. And two, the delegation, I think folks have to remember, we've got 9 members out of a 435-person body. We've been very fortunate because of some of the political influence that we've had in the past to be able to get our members here of the delegation on key committees. When we do get back into the majority, we'll serve the state extremely well with Congressman Neal as the head of the Ways and Means Committee. Jim McGovern, the head of the Rules Committee that decides every amendment and bill that comes to the House floor, will go through Jim's fingertips. And so the reason why we've been able to do that is that we band together to try to help each other out where we can.
So this was an opportunity to help out a colleague, as
this
you
was
said.
This had nothing to do with, again, no, I get the world of Ayanna, given her history, even again with my dad. It has more to do with as a way of trying to make sure that the delegation is able to be as effective as we can be, try to sit there and work with each other. And the personal relationship that I have, candidly, with Mike.
Right. But let me ask you what message Presley's victory sends to the Democratic Party. Because, again, the Democrats were surprised. It was sort of like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. People didn't see it coming. And it seems like the Democrats need to sort of take stock of what happened here. And what's the message? How to do that?
I might disagree with you a little bit. I think that people didn't see it coming. Mike, I think from the moment that Ayanna got in that race, Mike knew that that was a serious challenge.
Yeah.
Right? She was a sitting elected official in the city of Boston. She's everybody, even folks that would support Mike, understand that she's got enormous political talent. She's got a powerful message. She is a known political force in her own right. And so she was not, and I don't mean to disparage Ms. Ocasio-Cortez at all, but I think Ms. Ocasio-Cortez, one could make a legitimate argument that she kind of snuck up on somebody.
Out of the blue, right.
Ayanna wasn't sneaking up on anybody. Yes, was it a surprise that she won and by that margin? Sure. But people knew that I knew, Mike knew, that Ayanna had has some extraordinary political talent. And as he said in his concession speech, that she will make an extraordinarily strong member of the delegation. So what does it say? It says, I think, it says Democrats got to be willing to stand up and fight. And it means that you got to be forceful. You got to be visible in your district. You got to be making sure that people know that you're fighting for them, that you're standing for them every single day. I think it also sends a very powerful message, particularly in Democratic circles, that people want a Congress that is going to be reflective not just of how they look, but their passions, their motivations, how they vote, and what they feel. And I think for me, it's not enough. One of the messages I take from it is to say, look, it's not enough to be able to say, I understand where you're coming from. Here's how I'm working within this committee process to try to solve X issue. You gotta show up. You gotta be making sure that people understand that that they know that you're fighting for them, even if you can't necessarily invite them into the inner workings of how Congress might or might not operate. Because that's hard to explain to anybody, even if you're still there.
Congressman, last week you were in Indiana and Michigan campaigning for Democrats out there. So those are states that Trump won in 2016. What did Democrats have to do to prevail there? I mean, I know you were looking at congressional races, but still, same kind of questions apply.
So first thing they got to do is they got to show up.
Yeah.
It was a great trip for me. I spent a day or so crisscrossing Michigan and then a full day running across Indiana with House and Senate colleagues in both states. Look, I think the critical piece, regardless of whatever seat you're running for, whether it's a governor's race or a House race or a state rep race, it's awfully hard to ask somebody to vote for you if you never show up. And I think what we've seen is, particularly across that area around the Great Lakes and in Michigan, is that people, if you're going to ask them to throw a vote your way, if you're going to ask them to put their faith and their credibility and their belief in you, if you're going to ask that, if you're going to try to build up their credibility, your credibility with those voters, you got to at least show them the decency to show up and ask. So one, you show up. Two, you listen. You understand what the challenges are that they're confronting, and you do your best to respond to it. Three, and I think this is particularly pertinent to House races, you get candidates that are reflective of the values and vision of their district, that can give voice to the challenges and the aspirations of the folks that they seek to serve, and that are willing to then go out there and do everything they can to make that come to pass. And look, that's why I am excited about the prospects in November. Not just because you sit there and say, hey, we're against Donald Trump. Sure, fine. That's a big piece to it. I don't agree with the administration on much. But you also got to be for something. It's not enough. Democratic Party, I know and I love, and the reason why I'm in office, now I'm finishing my third term, I didn't come into office to try to fight against Donald Trump, who at that point was a reality TV star. You came because I believe, that every single person in this country deserves to be seen and heard, and that they've got potential that should be maximized, and that government has a role in making that so, and that we need to make investments, whether that's in healthcare or in infrastructure or in education, to enable people to realize it and to put our people out front and then support them along the way. And I think that's what you're seeing in these Democratic candidates across the country, is that they're able to take a similar message, craft it in their own way, but run on it. And they're doing pretty well.
One more question, and this is sort of a big kind of political question about the future of the Democrats. I mean, it seems like one of the things that the Democrats need to come to terms with, and I actually talked to you about this shortly after the 2016 election down in your office in Washington, and it's this question. So Donald Trump won. He got 1 million votes even here in Massachusetts, and you just said Democrats have to do more than just be against Donald Trump. I'd sort of argue that they've got to understand why Donald Trump 100%. Won and why so many people voted for him. Do you think that they've done a sort of the sufficient homework, I guess, trying to make sense of that?
I think we're working on it. So look,
that's an honest answer.
both in Massachusetts and around the country. Most of the political conversations I get in, as you can probably imagine, it starts with something around Donald Trump because of the news of the day, including today, and the chaos that comes with this White House on either their actions or their inability to actually effectuate much, and the frustration and the chaos that comes with it. But after you kind of get through that, if you actually listen to folks, and as I run around my district, which is largely outside of Boston, south and west down to Rhode Island, the issues that come up that people bring up are some mix of the cost of housing, the cost of a college education, disparate educational outcomes at the primary and secondary level, criminal justice, and I would argue a mental health system that is not anywhere close to our values, ends up incarcerating an awful lot of folks that are sick, transportation infrastructure, commuter rail, T that does not work. All of those are the ones that affect people most, the ones that they bring up. We have to acknowledge Donald Trump did not cause any single one of those problems. Donald Trump isn't the reason why the T catches on fire. Donald Trump isn't the reason why the commuter rail doesn't run on time. Donald Trump isn't the reason why middle-class families can't afford to live in Boston. Donald Trump is not addressing any of those issues, but he didn't cause them. And until you actually start focusing on the reasons that the cracks in our society that allowed Donald Trump to flourish, I think if Democrats don't focus on that, you are missing the warning signs that an electorate just sent you about saying, hey, we want change and we're going to vote for the guy that so shook the place up that a number of folks, myself included, didn't think it was ever possible that he could win because of how outlandish he was, missing the fact that there's some folks out there that voted for him because he was outlandish. Mm-hmm. We're globalization, automation. We've got structural gains in our structures in our economy that have enabled for enormous wealth creation. But 50% of Americans don't own a single stock. So when you hear somebody tout the latest stock market increase, 50% of American public doesn't get any of it. We don't know when the economy is going to turn. Hopefully it doesn't. But these things normally do come in cycles. You're going to have an entire generation, if not more, that over the course of this boom is not going to have actually gotten the benefits of it, but then is going to get hit in a devastating way if it does turn. And that's where we got to be paying more attention.
All right. Congressman Joe Kennedy, he represents Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District. Thanks so much for coming in. Always good to talk to you.
Hey, thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help today from Eve Zakoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.